Say hi, everyone. I'm recording today's episode on the legalization of sex work and how that affects those in the industry voluntarily and forcibly. Today, our guest is Madeline Rees, who's a British lawyer and currently a fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Madeline has a lot of experience. She's brought cases to the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court in Luxembourg. She served as the head of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and their gender expert in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Govina, during which tenure she gained a reputation for her work on counter-trafficking, and she was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to human rights, particularly human rights, women's rights. Would you like to say anything about yourself?
Oh, I should add in actually, because I was also a professor of practice at the LSE for several years with Christine Chinkin in her brilliant unit that is no longer functioning there, unfortunately, on women, peace, and security.
Could you tell us what inspired you to go into human rights law?
Ooh, now that could take up an entire podcast. The very, very short background out would be that I've always been intrinsically interested in why we commit acts of violence. And so I had volunteered at rape crisis centres, in domestic violence shelters. So I knew a lot about how law was not representing the truth about what was happening with women. I then spent a lot of time in Argentina, a couple of years in Argentina, working with women's organisations there. This is under the generals, which just shows how old I am. And they were doing amazing work on trying to combat violence against women, as well as doing lots of human rights networking and understanding how to resist. Eventually, I ended up in Nicaragua at the ending of their revolution at the invitation of the women's organization there, AMLI. Because again, I had got experience of working rape crisis. They wanted to look at European models so that they could actually emulate it, because the levels of violence against women in Nicaragua were horrific after the ending of the conflict. Can you believe it? The men finished, the women had been equally participant, if not more, engaged in the revolution than men. And then the minute it ended, it was back to the kitchen girls and extremities of violence. And essentially what they had, they were writing the constitution, trying to put in the feminist version of the constitution. And I was sitting there and they said, "Why aren't you a lawyer? Because what we need," she said, look what's happening here. "We need international lawyers, feminists, who can help to transform the international legal system so that we have solidarity across countries, because one country on their own, it won't work. We've got to have this feminist solidarity. We've got to make sure that we have law, international law, regulating human rights in individual countries with a proper functioning mechanism to uphold it." So I thought, well, actually, that's a very good idea. It was very important. So I went off and requalified, and then I was practicing as a lawyer in Britain, but a lot of it was becoming human rights, because it was mainly discrimination law and practice I was doing. So we relied on internet on European law. Obviously, that's the trip to Luxembourg and to Strasbourg, to protect fundamental rights. And then Bosnia was happening at the same time, and we hadn't paid enough attention to it. So I then got involved with Christine Chinkin from the LSE. She very kindly shared with me her amicus brief to the ad hoc tribunal in relation to how rape should be prosecuted. I got involved in that. Eventually, I then ended up being asked by a women's organization in Bosnia if I would go and explain how the International Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia was working, because women were coming to their shelters, but they weren't going forward to testify. So I went and basically got completely caught up in all the whole human rights situation in Bosnia, because of the ending of the conflict, and ended up going to work there for the UN. So that's how I got into it. So it was more a curiosity about violence and an absolute feeling that we've got to stop it, particularly violence by men. And what the structural relationship of that is, and how we could try to use law to act as a preventative tool as well as an accountability tool. So, looking at how we can change things using legal regulation and adherence to it. Yeah, but those women from Amla, their vision has, to a great extent, in greater extent than I thought would be possible in my lifetime, been realized. It's not done, and we face pushback all the time. And the intrinsic structural discrimination that is experienced is still there. But if you think, when I first started doing law, we didn't have half of the protections that we've got now. The entire legal systems have always been, like history. Women were never written into history, let alone written out of it. So you've got entire structures, history, law being written from the male gaze. And as a result of that, when it came to the ad hoc tribunals at the ending of the adjudicating for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, they were trying to force things like sexual violence into international humanitarian law in ways which just totally inappropriate, because essentially IHL had been written in order to have women were basically the property of a man. So basically, her integrity had already been taken from her by nature of a sexual violent act committed against her, but it wasn't prosecuted as it should have been for the crime committed against her. That has now changed. It's absolutely, we've moved from that situation through the ad hoc tribunals, where rape is now seen as torture, an element of genocide in certain circumstances, a crime against humanity, and a war crime. Now, that in our own right, and it's because the tribunals with very brilliant women prosecutors and incredibly brave women going forward and telling what had happened to them, it enabled law to describe what actually happens, rather than a male gaze as property rights, all the rest of it. So that fundamentally changed things. And then at the same time, we then have this. From there, we've gone into a matter of international criminal law. We've gone from that into gender persecution at the ICC, and the brilliant paper that was done by Lisa Davis, which basically shows that gender persecution lies in the violation of fundamental human rights from a gender perspective, and walks you through the entire scenarios when they happen. And essentially, it is now an internationally recognized law, probably not by Americans, but there you go, and is being charged. And then you move from that to where we are now in terms of the advocacy that's being undertaken, particularly by women from Afghanistan, but also by Iran, and by us, because it's the same everywhere, that you've got to start looking at the crime of gender apartheid. Now, the High Commissioner for Human Rights has actually spoken to that. The Special Rapporteur on Afghanistan has spoken to that. It's becoming something which we have to understand, and that is when you have institutionalized discrimination through acts of legislation, decree, or whatever, to prevent women enjoying rights. So it moves, so we've gone a long, long way, and I think that the law has helped enormously in trying to make that a reality. One other thing I'd just add, because Hilary Charlesworth, she's a judge at the ICJ, and she gave a talk here in Geneva just a couple of weeks ago. And she was challenged to say, well, what's the point in law within the ICJ, because you've got no enforcement mechanisms, and so people can just ignore. And she said, well, this is not the court is not there to enforce. The court is there to guide us through what we have agreed already between us. We have agreed certain things should not happen, and there must be certain consequences if they do. But around that, you've got to build the culture, the science, the architecture to make that work. And that is not the job of the court to do. It is for society and governments through policies to do. And us, people who have to or should respect those rules that we have agreed to. So I think that, to me, is where we are at the moment. And I think I am optimistic that despite the horrors of the pushback and the ignorance of people regarding law, we have to keep cleaving to it, because it's what we've got, and it will still be there when the likes of Trump and his clowns go, I hope.
Yeah, I hope. I think, no, I absolutely agree. The law is so important. I think I'm just worried, as someone who's like, I suppose, an outside observer at the moment, it feels a lot like you change the law, but how do, it doesn't change the society, and the society is perhaps more important.
Point because it's catch up. Often the law will go first. I mean, the trans case, for example, that meant full protection for transsexuals. Now we refer much more to transgender, whatever. The law was a little bit ahead, but it applied the teleological approach, saying people are just about ready for this now because we've changed them. Now we understand more, science has moved on, society has moved on. And to be honest, then nobody cared. Nobody cared. It was just fine, of course, people. And now it's been used as a tool to create antipathy towards a persecuted minority. So it can go both ways. But I think the law can go first in actually giving us a sort of a guidance as to how we should conduct ourselves. And I think, I mean, just the Pellico case in France, hugely important, hugely.
I think what scares me about the Pellico case, though, is I fear that it shows in a lot of ways society is not going forwards, it's going backwards, and it's the law that's kind of like barely holding it together.
That's
But
true. You're a glass half full person. But it exposed it, and the reaction, there were millions of people around the world watching that case and shocked, and it really blew open the reality of it. And I think that's half the problem, is that so much of what happens in societies is we don't see it,
we
and
choose
so
not to see it.
we've not to see it. And if it once it's really blown open and thrown in your face like that, then it shocks you into thinking these were ordinary men, and what on earth did they think they were doing? But yeah, I do appreciate your position on it because sometimes it's very hard to
No,
to
but
be very.
you have to have some sort of optimism, because otherwise, what's the point, you know? I think it's also like for your mental sanity and mental health.
Totally right. Totally right. I mean, I think that thing is, we can do things. We really, really can. And it just behoves us to take the agency to make them happen.
Could you tell me a bit how your experience working on counter trafficking has informed your views on sex work and the sex industry?
It was not a field I had anticipated getting heavily involved in, but because of what was going on in Bosnia, I ended up being very heavily involved in the whole thing. I think probably I didn't have an opinion about sex work before. And in Bosnia, the law then was that it was illegal for, it was a minor misdemeanor for both parties, for the woman selling sex and the man buying sex. But of course, it was only ever women who were prosecuted. And it was how we just uncovered the trafficking in the first place, because a friend of mine who was a judge saying she's getting women from Moldova, Ukraine, brought in front of her on a regular basis for prostitution. And she said, but it's weird, but and she had to deport them from the canton. That was because we're foreigners. But then they come back. And she said it was so then we started looking at and we realized these were not women working voluntarily in any sort of sex work. They'd been trafficked. And that's how we started uncovering the whole network of what was going on. And it was this is the, I think just to explain the trafficking part, Bosnia was the perfect storm. There were some 80,000 male, mainly men, peacekeepers there. There were Moldova, Romania, Ukraine, all had just ended, the Cold War had ended, the economies had collapsed, and women were being offered possibilities of working in hotels, to train as hairdressers in Western Europe for substantial amounts of money. Of course, all not true. They were being trafficked, and they were being trafficked into Bosnia specifically to be used as sex workers for the unwilling sex workers for the international community, because at the time only the international community had access to or could travel freely around, and there was curfews. So, it was very much a very, it showed how incredibly important the market is for sex in relation to trafficking, because it's capitalism on steroids. That's what it is, basically, because the most successful, the traffickers, were very brilliant entrepreneurs. They saw there was a market, they moved people to the market, they controlled the market, they made huge amounts of money, bought off the police when they had to. You went totally complicit. And it was that scenario which made it really hard to crack. And the other thing, I think this goes back to your point about society, the Bosnian population had just ended a conflict. They thought these women had been brought in as foreign prostitutes for the foreigners. They thought it was a foreign problem. So they were not outraged by it. It was only when local NGOs started exposing what was happening in the local communities, where every little village would have at some point a place where women were being forced into prostitution, that it started, and the true stories about the horrific exploitation that took place. It's only when that came out that the population started criticizing what was happening and trying to get proper and effective responses from both their government and from the international community. And that's when we were able to operate better on it. But yeah, I mean, it was really, and there was, it had started even during the conflict itself, seemingly. Because there were stories of women being there from 93 onwards. And the other thing that I think is very, it was characterized in its initial stages, it was characterized by extreme violence. People were killed. And I don't know if you've seen the film The Whistleblower, which is about the trafficking into Bosnia made by a brilliant Canadian Ukrainian. And it's not accurate in terms of who did what, but it's absolutely accurate in relation to what happened to the women. And some of the script is actually lifted from statements we took from women who have been trafficked. So it does tell their story from recruitment right the way through to death as being, sadly what happened. We'll never know how many thousands of women were brought into Bosnia, but there were a lot. So that was a trafficking sign, and that goes on. I mean, I just at a conference fairly recently in Vienna, and the extent of trafficking for sexual purposes, sexual exploitation, is still enormous. Still enormous. No matter what law is put in place, it seems that they are able to get around it. And just I think during the course of this work, I mean, of course, we did a huge amount of work with police, different nationalities of police as well. So met with police from Sweden, and where there's the Nordic laws in place, which criminalizes the man, not the woman, with police from Holland, unit where it was legal, Germany. All the police we met said the same thing. None of the laws that there's been put in place, whether it be criminalization or legalization, none of it works. It's as best as they can do. I mean, the Dutch said that, they had got there was a woman police officer, and she was responsible for working in the red light district to try and make sure the girls were safe. But she said the problem was that was regulated, and it did work. But because it wasn't risky enough for some men, and because there's always a market for someone who's more exotic, there were illegal brothels being set up outside the purview of the state, in places which were very remote and dangerous, and men would go there. So it's to do with it's a psychology. There's a psychology to it as well. I did speak to several of the guys who were who went to these places, which they've said were brothels, and they one of them, she said to me, never underestimate the power of male cognitive dissonance. So even though you could see that she's trafficked, she doesn't speak English, she doesn't get paid, she's not in good condition, even though you have all of that in front of you, you refuse to think that she is a sex slave, because you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't have sex with someone who was undermined, would you? You wouldn't do that. And you can explain all these things away to yourself, but then they come back to the, but she's just a whore in any case, so it doesn't matter. That was the default position. And he said it comes from the top. If you've got the leadership saying, absolutely not, under no circumstances, human rights protections, you name it, all the arguments you should put forward as to why you shouldn't abuse women, it's got more chance of working than if not. But you will always find those who want to go and have this excitement. I mean, one British guy, he told me that he'd been in Central America and Honduras. And he said that, they did think about setting up places for sex work to prostitute, legal, sort of not legalized, but to have brothels on bases so that the men would be fine, they wouldn't go off into town. But he said that that wasn't exciting enough. It's got to be, you want to dig your way out of as a camp, you've got to do something exciting and wrong and naughty and everything else, which makes it much more exciting. So it's really hard to regulate. And I think that's part of the problem we've got, is it's about equality when it comes down to it. It's about equality. And that's where we have to look at sex work in that parameter, rather than thinking of it as a moral or a moral or immoral issue. Most important by far, and this is why, because I know many of the feminists who are in favor of the Swedish laws, and it was put in place in France, it was adopted in France. And just to say that, I should go back a little bit just to say about the Bosnian situation, because whilst it was characterized by the extremity of violence in the first place, what we often found as time went on, after a year or so, the violence was reduced somewhat, and the bar owners and the nightclub owners were starting to pay women, and they were able to pay off the debt that they had incurred. But they'd already been forced into prostitution. So what they wanted to do was to earn enough money, 2,000, they were said, 2,000 euros. If I can just earn 2,000 euros, I can go home and no one will ask me what happened. So they could go back, and that history would be erased. I mean, psychologically, not obviously, but they would not be then ostracized by their communities. And so what they were doing is they would go from a, they'd managed to get out of somewhere which was really exploitative, and they would actually ask us where were the, well, they would know, or where could they go where they could earn more money and be safe. And that's how the illegality of the trafficking morphed into a much less violent and semi-legal industry. And the same, I mean, just to say, the same, the reverse has happened in France, where they adopted the Swedish model. We always said that, the Swedish model is a great idea. I mean, it is a great idea in theory, but in practice, it doesn't work, because you basically are criminalizing the guy, but you can't keep the woman safe. You can't keep her safe. She can't be in a place with other people selling sex, so there can be no solidarity and watching over. It's illegal for the guy, so it's going to go underground, which of course it does. And that puts her at risk. And in France, they did the same thing. And before, it was regulated, but they were saying that there were places in most of the main cities where you could go and you could buy sex, and there were brothels. And it was, they were protected, they had health checks, that sort of thing. Now, you go along the road out towards Burgundy, out that way, and there are little white vans in lay-bys all over the place, and it's mainly trafficked women, lots of women from Africa apparently, and they live in these places. They're brought there by gangs, and they're kept in these vans on their own where they live. They have to do everything there, and of course they're at huge risk, because there's no one there to support them at all. They can either get raped and the guy walks away with no payment at all. The police can't possibly regulate it, because they've actually got to catch the guy having sex with her and paying for it. And of course, they catch her having sex, he's going to say she was voluntary having sex with him, isn't it? So they can't do anything, because we've been to so many different, people in the areas that they've been there, they've talked to the women, they've talked to the police. I spoke to the mayor, he spoke to the police. No one can do anything about it, theoretically, because it's fallen through all the various cracks of different pieces of legislation. And that's insane. And that's because of the adoption of this particular law, which is ineffective. So in theory, great idea, but it just makes it impossible. And in fact, it makes it, as we were saying before, that little bit of added danger. So it doesn't work. Gotta find ways of making, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, women would not have to sell sex. But we are not in the best of all possible worlds. So, we have to then just basically do whatever we can as lawyers to ensure that the law protects them as far as it is humanly possible, and that the stigma that's being attached to it is removed, because that's what makes it more dangerous.
So in this sense, I would you say that your take is that while the Nordic model is a form of legalization, it's that form of legalization which does hurt sex workers and women in the industry? Because I think I agree with you in a lot of ways, right? It's a great idea theoretically, and I think morally, the Nordic model is very, like, I suppose it's appealing because it does seem to, enforce some sort of punishment on the person who's doing something. I think you could say it's ethically wrong, and I would personally say it's ethically wrong to go and buy sex, right? Well, it's not punishing the person who's selling it, but in reality, it just winds up in more danger for all of the women selling sex.
Yeah, it does. And, how dare we throw women who need protection under the bus because they happen to be poor? Because how many, it's difficult to say, but I mean, again, you've got situations where if your choice is selling sex or working for 15 hours a day in a sweatshop and not being allowed to go use the bathroom so you get urinary infections and, it's not much of a choice, but one is easier.
Yeah.
That's the stigma. So it's really, and if you think of, how women organise and the women who are trafficked into Calcutta and then the sex workers, that whole story is just amazing what they managed to do to organise for healthcare, for pooling of resources. They send their kids to Harvard now, it's amazing because they controlled it. And here in Geneva, it's legal. Prostitution is legal, and the police have said multiple times that the way in which they can address trafficking is because the women who are in the sex industry, they know when people have been trafficked in, and they can help. So they can help the police to get the bad guys and the traffickers and to get the support. So we've got to be more intelligent and I think understanding of the position and it's the position of the person who is at risk that we have to identify and protect.
Yeah, I
And
think
that sex work is very clear on it.
the practical repercussions are what matter more so than the, like, theological, I suppose, place of the law.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I think what you were saying about the Nordic law, it is good because it is saying to men, no, you shouldn't. It's because that's the whole point of it, to show that men can't just buy a woman's body. I mean, that is a strong message to send, but the cost is too high. We can send that message in different ways.
Yeah. I think one thing that I found interesting, so I was looking at, how I suppose a lot of people justify the Nordic model and what, r statistics show, which obviously can be questioned because how do you measure the market in prostitution, right? Of course it's going to be underground. But statistics seem to show that the Nordic model, because it criminalizes demand, reduces the market entirely because there's obviously just a portion of men who say, okay, now that it's illegal, I'm not going to buy sex. And I think there is, you could say there's an argument to be made for the fact that because the entire market shrinks, maybe, there's less women in the industry in total. Maybe that's better, but it doesn't protect better the women that are then left in the industry.
No, that's a good point. I think that the problem you identified is the statistics. How on earth do you measure it?
Yeah.
There has been, I mean, there's some really good research that came out of University of, was it Amsterdam? Or Leiden, I forgot which one. But it was really showing how the statistics that have been put out in justifying the Nordic model were really fundamentally flawed because they were so speculative.
Yeah.
There's a film, we saw it, Lilia Forever. It
No.
was amazing, amazing film. It was the story of a young woman who was trafficked from, it's a true story. There was a bridge now in Stockholm, I think, with Lilia on it, because a young woman trafficked from Russia into Sweden, where the Nordic laws were applying. And so she was horrifically abused. And in the end, she ended up escaping. And because she was scared of the police, she didn't dare go to the police, she killed herself. And so Lilia Forever was made in Switzerland, a true story. In Sweden, sorry, true story. So whilst we have all of that, it's just too risky. There are other mechanisms we could use. I love the idea of shrinking the market, but At what cost?
Exactly, yeah. Just to ask personally, as a feminist though, what are your, I guess, views on sex work and the sex industry?
Problematic, I mean, for all the reasons that we've just said, you've got to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and seeing what economic opportunities people have and why people go in, why women go into the sex industry. And I've met loads of women who have chosen to go into the sex industry. And I can't judge them. I can't judge them. And it was very interesting, the Bosnia experience, because so many of the Bosnians were just super pragmatic about it. It didn't have the stigma it, amongst many of the women I was working with that it does in the rest of Europe. And it was partly because it was seen as transactional. It was basically, there was one friend of mine, she said she'd actually been to Oxford University. And some of the women there were working as high-class escort women down in London. And she was asked if she wanted to as well, because they were making thousands because it was really at market. And she didn't. She said, "I didn't do it because of any moral or anything else." She just said it was just such easy money. I knew that I would just get completely caught up in doing that. Anytime I needed something, I would go off and do that. There's brothels in Switzerland that have women come and go from the Balkans, when they get short of money, because they're looked after. They're well protected, they're well paid. It's an option that some women take, and therefore my position on it is just if that's to be taken, then back to the protection, they have to be made to be safe. And we have to respect the agency of women. It's not for us to judge. I would judge the men. I will, for sure, because that's a very different thing. They want to buy a woman's body. But I think for the women, it's way more complicated. And I really, really feel that the job of law, to keep reiterating, is to make it as safe as is humanly possible. So that violence that we're talking about is never allowed to be present without massive consequence.
What is your thoughts on the fact that, many organizations made up of sex workers support full decriminalization and not legalization to any extent, right? So the idea that by removing any legal barriers, then you have the most agency and the most ability for sex workers to decide what is safest for themselves, to build up their own networks.
No, and that's true. Only the women in the sex industry will know this because they're the ones who know how it works intimately, and they also know what can best keep them safe. Would I campaign on that? Probably not, but because I think it does have other consequences. And back to your position, your thing about the market. Maybe by increasing the market, you increase the, well, you, legalization does enable an increase in the market, and then it actually creates, I was going to say opportunities, but that's not what I mean. But it does mean that more women will probably end up going into sex work, especially in these very chastened economic climate. And that's not good. So we've got to protect against that as well, which is why maybe regulation is better. But we don't know. I mean, we really don't know because it hasn't worked anyway. So I mean, it keeps coming back to that. Law has failed in all its various attempts to change it. It's got to be, and I know I said earlier in our conversation that sometimes the law has to go first and society will follow. Well, I think in this case, it hasn't worked that way around because we're still struggling to try and find out how to regulate sex and everything that, all the social and mores that go with it.
Is legalization a good middle ground, or should we just go full decriminalization?
I don't know the answer to that. Again, we haven't found a successful model.
Because I think the issue with legalization as well, right, is you say, okay, it somewhat keeps the market contained, but it also creates a further inequality between people in the sex industry themselves. So the most marginalized sex workers, illegal immigrants, those being coerced, if not trafficked, go further underground. Some women who can benefit from legalization will be able to make more money, like you were talking about earlier, but others will be suffering even more.
Yep, and then we're again full circle. We don't really know, do we? I think there's things that could be done, which would help. If, for example, you were to legalize it, then there should be then any man who wants to go and avail themselves of a sex service has to register. And if they're not registered, then they are committing either a civil act or a criminal act, depending on what the legislation would say. And I think there would also have to be a compulsion, for example, and this you know what you could go on the website, you can check out from male punters what if there's whether they liked a particular brothel or not, they've done that. And if it were that they were trusted to do, some guys put out there, this is a very, don't go there. She's the prostitutes are very young and most don't speak English. Well, then you've got a red flag. Because again, some of the men that I came across in Bosnia context, it was them that helped because they thought they were going to a brothel and they ended up where they were not paying for, but to a woman who was voluntary and they wanted to take some action against it. So you can start changing the market by different forms of regulation within it, which some fall some way between legalization, decriminalization, and a combination of civil and criminal law. That would be, I think maybe we should talk a lot more about that rather than, with sex workers, and with women who have been trafficked, because they know the other side of how they ended up where they were. And it's very interesting, you very rarely get women who've been trafficked leading any of the movements against trafficking. And I think that's for security reasons, but it's amazing we didn't have, of the hundreds and hundreds of women that came through the various shelters and everything else, they all just wanted to go home.
Yeah, I
Or,
mean,
but yeah.
that's really interesting. And I actually had never thought about that. But yeah, I think, of course, there's this like aversion to wanting to go into the court system of that country when you yourself are violating the laws of that country to an extent. That's a really interesting hypothetical you brought up about kind of having the registration of buyers of sex work. I think, do you think that would ever work? Do you think that men would do that?
No, I don't think so. Which is telling, isn't it? Which is telling. I mean, it's like it goes back to the Pellico case. They were all perfectly willing to take advantage of Giselle when she was unconscious with the permission of her husband, and then you wonder, well, if they'd signed a register beforehand, of course they wouldn't. Of course they wouldn't. So I think it might be, it's a conversation we should have, and a conversation with, again, with sex workers and with men who do want to use.
Do you think that men who buy sex should be included in the conversation?
Well, I think this because I this it's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's so many different reasons why men would buy sex. I mean, the one is I think that there is still it's misogynistic. There is this thinking, I want to have sex, so I should get it, and if I have to pay for it, well, I'll pay for it, but not much. And this is the sort of, not the the high class hotels and places like that where people sell sex, because that's I think at least slightly different in terms of the amounts that they would put into it. But I think that there's different ways. I mean, one guy in particular who went on to become he was a police officer from Pakistan, and he was very concerned with human rights. And he said, he told me that when he got picked up when he first got to Bosnia by the contingent. Before they were even taken to where they were going to be staying, they pointed out the brothels that they went to on Saturday nights. This is where we go, boys, sort of thing. And he eventually found out there was lots of trafficking going on, so there's no way he was going. And he actually had to have physical fights with people who wanted to force him to go because it was the Band of Brothers type mentality. It was, this is what we do on Saturday nights. And you're on your own. We're in a, basically, you're on your own in a strange country. You don't speak the language. The only people you've got that you can trust to be with are your Band of Brothers. And you don't want to ostracize them or alienate them in any way. So there is that pack mentality. It's the same with the boys who go out. They're pack animals. They act like pack animals when it comes to things like that. Often there's lots of alcohol involved as well. And so they don't want to be the one who says no. And that's what I think is the interesting thing about registration. So why, if we talk to them, why do you do it? Most of them say, well, because everyone else was. And then you're going to have then you will have others. And I have not pursued this at all. I've not interviewed them. I've not taken it further to find out what the motivation is and who they are. But maybe I'm sure the research has been done. But it would also be, I think, interesting to try and tease out how we could address this in ways which are less emotive and more practical. Because everyone gets hot under the collar about sex work for very obvious reasons, and it's all to do with, our attitudes towards sex, full stop, isn't it really? But I do worry with social media now and this explosion that it's all right to choke a woman and all these sorts of things, because that's going to be played out for sure in the sex industry with an increase in violence, no doubt.
On the topic of social media, I think it's really interesting to think about the more legally gray areas of online prostitution. I don't know. What are your opinions on things like OnlyFans and these kinds of like online forums for selling sex?
I don't know about them. I'm not on social media. How do they work?
So, what's been around for a while is obviously pornography, right? So that I think I can regard that as a form of online prostitution in a sense where, women go online and they sell their videos to these websites and they make money
Oh,
off
right.
those. But then more recently, there's been a phenomenon of something more akin to like individual prostitution, but online. So there's this app website called OnlyFans where women go, they make an account, and then men will pay to subscribe to see their content. And yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's like, I think my views on prostitution, pornography are, put it this way, I think pornography, the way that pornography is right now, is appalling. I mean, it's because, and that is another form of misogyny, for sure, because it's done for the male purview. And it's interesting that you've got young women doing it, but what are they doing? Are they doing what they think that men will like? Presumably they are, because that's why men are signing up to watch it. And that has become increasingly violent. So I think, again, it's got to be regulated.
Yeah, and I think the issue is it is regulated in the sense that, oh, you have to be 18 to create an account or, whatever, so they say. But how do you regulate something that's on the internet, You can lie about anything, on the internet.
Yeah,
I think
it is scary.
what is interesting is that it's in a way, especially with OnlyFans, where these women, I suppose, have a lot more control, or they should have a lot more control over their, own accounts and their own finances, is it's become, I think, it's become a really lucrative market. I mean, OnlyFans is making a lot of money as a business, but also you have a lot of promotion online of, online prostitution of women encouraging other women to get into online prostitution, mostly actually in countries where, there is no, not the same economic hardship. In developed countries, women promoting this lifestyle as a get rich quick scheme. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the power of money. And how do they protect? I mean, how? Because I mean, my concern would be, apart from it sounds pretty vile, but then strange that I would say that. Somehow it seems worse than sex work. I mean, it is a form of sex work. It's probably safer. I mean, it probably is safer than sex work. But it's pornography, and then we're back into the dangers of pornography as a tool for increasing and enhancing violence against women. So how do you, I mean, the regulation should come when things are being done which are illegal. Choking, things like that. So if they are emulating something which would be illegal if done in in real life, real time, then that should be clearly controlled. But as I say, it's again hard to say when you're not in a situation where you don't have a lot of opportunities. Putting yourself in the position of the women doing it.
Think, and I absolutely agree. I think what is so interesting about this, like online prostitution and OnlyFans, though, is that what seems to be the case, so many of these women do have the option not to do this, and it's being promoted as, like, it's being marketed in, I think, a very dangerous way towards young girls, right? And a very encouraging way, because especially, in the US, where I think OnlyFans is the most popular and where most OnlyFans creators are, you really think, what has made us have this extreme shift towards, socially thinking it is okay to do this, it is okay to encourage women to want to have this as their entire career. And I mean, I guess that brings us back again to like the moral or theological argument, but I do want to talk about this idea of should sex work be regarded as a work, as a profession akin to any other?
I think we have to, because what you don't want is you don't want women who are, because it's very different once you're in the sex, it would be better if they were able to pay taxes and pay into pension funds so that they're not then bereft once they have to stop working. And it goes with the whole, let's find an appropriate way of keeping women safe. And I think what you're saying about these OnlyFans thing is, again, it's an expansion of misogyny, because women feel that it's a good way to get rich quick, and it's all being promoted on social media, which is a very alienating experience in any case, because it's not personal. It's that thing where we're being dragged into a socialization process online, which isn't human. We're not doing it with humans. We're not having that interaction. We cannot feel the empathy because we can't do the mirroring. We can't do any of the things that the neuroscientist and the psychologist says is so vital to our well-being. We can't do. And so it's easy. So you'll increase the amount of men who are watching pornography. You'll increase, as a result of that, the levels of violence against women, because it's seen as being normalized within their own psyche. And so it goes on. I know I sound like a sort of, backward looking, but that is, to me, there's something very shocking about that descent into monetization of what women have to do in areas where it shouldn't be monetized, like online, because it's way more dangerous in the long term in terms of our socialization. It's back to Andrew Tate and his lot, because the marketing for that It's not that young boys, it's what I was saying very much earlier before you started recording. It's not that young boys are seeking out misogyny and pornography and that sort of thing. You open an account as a young man, and within half an hour, you've got deeply misogynistic content being offered to you and pornography. And then it becomes the algorithm kicks in, and there you have it. You have, and you think everybody else is doing this all the time, and everybody else is starting to do this all the time. And then you have it spreading into the education system, so it's in schools, it's normalized, and it's a really unpleasant trajectory. So that's my plan. Oh, Benji.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's we've opened too many things. We have opened too many things without having guardrails put in place, without seeing the potential consequences and making sure it's stopped before it starts.
No, I think you are so correct in saying that in the long term, it's more dangerous because I can absolutely see why, physically, it's safer, right? And you should say, yeah, we should be shifting it online to a sphere where women can't be, physically assaulted. And, maybe, they have more control. But it's just opening up this, opportunity for a social shift towards women in general. Becoming more and more sexualized in every aspect of their lives online, it becoming normalized for all women. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So instinctively, because I didn't know this, me and my lack of media savviness, I didn't know this existed. And instinctively, it's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, pornography, as looking at it, it's not the same, but it's interlinked, and I think like the idea of criminalizing pornography is very interesting to me because in an ideal world, if we lived in a feminist vacuum, we wouldn't have any pornography, but
We
we don't.
might, but it'd be very different. I was talking about that with a gay friend of mine actually the other day, a guy, and he was saying, because gay male porn is very different. Very different.
It doesn't have the same undertones of violence, I guess.
It's more equal.
Yeah.
Consensual more. No, it's, I think, pornography, because I'm old enough to remember when we did the Take Back the Night marches and used to go and take the pornography off the top shelves in the newsagents, that sort of thing,
I think what's interesting is thinking about it, theoretically, should we live in a world where there's any porn or any sex work at all? Or would we ideally be moving towards a world where none of this exists?
Very interesting, and I don't think we're again never going to tease that one out. But I will tell you, there was a friend of mine who had worked extensively on anti-trafficking work. She was involved in setting up a conference, a 3 days, I think it was, called Whores, Housewives, and Housekeepers. And basically, they had sex workers, wives, and housekeepers who came to discuss their lives. And of course, at the very beginning, it was seen as the housewives were the preeminent ones because they were respectable. And then the houseworkers, the housekeepers were in the middle. And of course, the women who sold sex were thought of as being in the lowest category of all. At the end of 3 days, it was the other way around because it was seen that essentially they had control over who they had sex with, when they had sex, and they got paid for it, and they could do it as much or as little as they wanted. Whereas in the house, the housekeepers had to, work bloody hard to clean the house and everything else and had regulated hours or whatever. And the wives were the ones who had to have sex whenever the husband wanted it and had to do the housework and all things. And in the end, it seems the life of the sex worker was actually better. So, it depends on the sex work and everything else. Of course it does. There's so many questions about all of that. But at the same time, the way that women have been basically just discriminated against in relation to all our institutions and our structures and the law is this the essence of our problem. Because when you've still got male neuroscientists who'd rather spend time trying to prove yet again that the male brain is superior to the female brain, we really have got work to do, have we not? So although I think, as I said at the beginning, there has been a revolution, and it is now women are seen everywhere at all times and must be. But in terms of attitudes, we still haven't got it completely cracked yet. And I think the talking about sex work and pornography is really perhaps at the sharpest end of where that divide still fundamentally exists.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to go back a little bit to the Nordic model, because the law itself, right there, regards sex work as an intrinsic abuse, an intrinsic form of violence. And I don't know, in some ways, I would say I personally agree with that. What would you say in reaction to that?
Oof. I've never had to sell sex, so I don't know. In theory, yes. I suppose in theory, yes. But in reality, difficult.
True. And obviously, it's talking about something that I have no real, understanding of, whereas sex workers should be leading the discussions as to what the law should be, right? But I think if you read testimonies as well, I can see why a law like that would be appealing because, it's the dehumanization, the slow, like, trying to separate the body from the self and the dissociation between the two, but eventually it is impossible to dissociate for that long.
We don't know. But in the end, it's a physical act, which, yeah, it's a physical act. And you get paid for it. So maybe we need to start, it's a different mindset shift. And I think, I know for myself that my disapproval of, it's not disapproval, that's wrong, my dislike of the fact that there is sex work does come from that belief that men should not be doing this to women. But that's a personal thing. I don't think men should be doing lots of things that they do. So, I would like to see a much more respectful relationship between men and women. And it's, I think we have made huge strides. We have, this is my lifetime. It really has changed dramatically. And I think this war on woke is most definitely to try and push us back to exactly that, which is why we've got to be even more, I think, audacious in our demands, because we've got to protect what we've got, while still moving towards greater equality. And I don't want to see, I want to see more men, questioning what's going on and why it's going on. Because I mean, the irony of it is in the UK, as you probably know, the highest rates of suicide are amongst young men. They are very much more at risk of self-harm because of depression and everything. And it's because of patriarchy, because they haven't got the perfect body. They haven't got the amounts of money they're supposed to have. They aren't, perhaps the best at competitive sports. But these essentializing manliness to those sorts of qualities is cruel and degrading for them. And of course it's because it's just not true. They come in all shapes and sizes and all the rest of it. We create this cult of masculinity and all that goes with it. So I think they would be helping themselves enormously if they sort of said, no, we don't want to be like this either.
Yeah, I
Especially.
mean, men who don't subscribe to right-wing ideals and patriarchy, I think, tend to be happier. Yeah.
Very much happier. Much happier. It was interesting. I was talking to a guy in the Norwegian military. He was very, very senior. And you know, they started having a 16% quota for women in the Norwegian military ages ago. Now it's supposed to be, you know, equal. And he said his lot, they'd all resisted like mad having women in the military with them, because they're saying, you know, it was a man-only space. And he said, but it was really interesting because he said, when he thought back about it, what did they talk about when they were together? Well, they'd talk about sex, they'd go off and get drunk, they'd watch sports. And he said, but really, it was quite boring. And then the women started coming in, and suddenly there were different conversations, and the nature of those conversations changed. And they all had a lot more happiness in their work because there was something else. And it wasn't, we've got to talk about this because we're men. You know, it was, but we could actually talk about other things. And I wondered, I've obviously been opposed to militarism and including women in the military as a, you know, part of the 1325 agenda and all the rest of it. But I just wonder that if over time, if you do end men-only spaces, then it can, the conversations do change and then the attitudes change. Because if language creates reality, which they say it does, then that will gradually end that divisiveness that we seem to be brilliant at perpetuating in various forms. And online more than anywhere else, way more than anywhere else right now.
I think it's a huge factor ending men's only spaces and having men, listen to women, right? That's how you combat this right-wing pipeline rhetoric. The issue is just with the internet, people choose exactly what to see and they choose, exactly what to look at and what opinions, and the algorithm chooses for them what opinions they're not going to be shown.
No, exactly. I think what's really frightening is that, I mean, again, the neurosciences will tell us that you are more fascinated by something which shocks you than you are by something which doesn't. So the more shocking the image, the longer you'll look at it, because it'll be like, oh my God, no, you know, and then that's the way it will generate its income, because basically you stay online longer, the advertising rates go up, and all that sort of thing. So, well, some of us like to look at, you know, little kittens doing strange things or whatever. My daughter loves having the birds, cockatoos dancing. I love that. But yeah, whilst there's those sorts of fun things, the disaster scrolling is partly because of the way in which our brains gravitate towards that, and then the emotions that are generated as a result. And so it means bad stuff gets out there, like they're saying with the Andrew Tates of this world. He's generating horrific content, and people want to go in on it because they think it's normal. Then, you know, it's sort of it's a very dangerous thing that we are doing without understanding it enough.
Yeah, I think to bring it back to sex work a bit, I think maybe a danger of decriminalization or legalization that I want to talk about more is the idea of making it normal, making it a profession, and making it obviously we should not stigmatize the sex worker, but is there something to be said for having, wariness of sex work in itself and not making it to be a legitimate, I suppose, or encouraged choice?
I think not an encouraged choice because of the inherent risks within it. I mean, that more than anything else for me is the way I would frame it. So you don't encourage, you don't want to encourage people to go and work in an industry which is inherently unsafe, even if you want to make it as safe as you can. Like, I wouldn't encourage anyone to go off and be a miner, you know, because it's inherently unsafe and the conditions are not pleasant. So it's that sort of thing. And then finding ways in which we educate ourselves better to be much more mutually respectful of each other and our personal spaces and what that means. And this is a debate that's been going on for how many centuries? You know, I don't think we're going to fix it just like that. But in the best of all possible worlds, basically where there is much greater economic equality across the board. I mean, I don't just mean between men and women, I mean just generally, where there's less poverty and we actually start getting things right, then there will be less need for women to have to sell sex in order to survive. And I think that is probably the bottom line. So when there's proper, informed, safe work available, then we can have a proper conversation about it. But I think at the moment, in these very difficult times, it's very difficult to have, to make any sort of, I would say, rational decisions around that or whatever. But I mean, it's the basic bottom line, keeping women safe. And we'll see what we can do around destroying economic systems of exploitation in the interim.
Yeah, I think no, absolutely. It's such a strong argument, as the conference you were talking about earlier reminded me. Like, even being, say, a housewife, which is something that is normalized and is, kind of seen as a valid career choice, is exploitative in its inherent sense.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
And it's just like, you can see why someone who's promoting sex work would say, well, I'm getting paid and you're not getting paid, you
Yeah.
know?
No, exactly. Especially when you think of the levels of domestic violence that there are. So,
Yeah, I mean, statistics around marriage are crazy to look at. I mean, women get more depressed, men get happier, women live shorter, men live longer. Like, it's crazy.
not a career choice, really, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to go, I'm afraid.
Thank you so much for coming on the call. This was so, so insightful.